Packet Pushers.
Welcome to Packet Protector, a podcast at the intersection of networking and security. I'm JJ Manella here with Drew Connery Murray, and today we're talking red teams and blue teams, purple teams, and well, no, we're not picking sides for a dodgeball game. We're talking about different approaches to cybersecurity attack and defense, the roles these teams play, how they fit into the broader approach to security and risk management. And who better to have this discussion than our guest today, Bryson Bort, who's the founder of threat emulation startup Scythe and founder of Grim, a cybersecurity consultancy company, and probably my favorite line for Bryson, co-founder of the ICS Village, which, if you haven't heard of it, is a nonprofit advancing awareness and industrial control security. And we will definitely be having Bryson back on another day to have a whole conversation around OT and ICS security. But first, hi guys, let's jump in with a couple of the security headlines.
In late January, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it had broken up a botnet. They're calling it KV botnet. It was made up of compromised SOHO routers, so small office, home office routers. And the botnet was reportedly being used by a Chinese hacking group called Volt Typhoon as proxies for further attacks against critical U.S. infrastructure. The FBI says it was able to disrupt the botnet network by removing malware from known compromised routers and, of course, disrupting communication with the command and control servers.
My reading on this, and I want to dive further into it, and I'm curious what Bryson's going to say, but what my understanding was, China or Chinese actors that comprise this group were taking over and using their own little malware networks and botnets to get geographic adjacency to their targets. And then they were using living off the land techniques. So basically, they were physically geolocated closer to what the target was going to be. So we didn't have that remote IP address coming in as one of our indicators. And then they were doing things that looked like normal admin work. We always talk about that hacking and attacking is really just misuse and abuse of standard sysadmin. So this was a little alarming to me. I'm glad that they were able to dismantle it, but I'm curious about like what this means for us and as a defender. How do we start to identify these attacks? What is actually happening here? There's obviously some political considerations. So Bryson, what do you think about this?
So JJ, you led off the episode with red, blue, and purple, all beautiful colors for unicorns. And we're going to add a different color here. We're going to add gray, because when you wake up in red space, which in this case is Beijing, and you decide you want to do something, you can't just go from a China IP directly. That's easy to stop. We can do geolocation, we can geofence, easy problem. And so the first innovation is the continual way to have either witting or unwitting assets that serve that gray space, which is what allows red to get to blue. And so we see an innovation here. Also in the headlines from yesterday, the Fortinet fake story on toothbrushes as a malicious botnet. It's all the same kind of idea. And that was my talk back in 2018 on no IOUs with IoT. That's the innovation we're seeing in the gray space. And that's the why. The second then is what is happening in blue. The first, which I've been saying for well over a decade, is you can't just wake up and attack industrial control systems or an entire sector of another country. It's much more complicated for that. And part of that goes to the fundamental secure design architecture that is there for functional reasons. Industrial control systems are meant to run and to work in all sorts of conditions. And so it's not as simple as just taking it out, which means you need to put what I call levers in place. I need to be having software that can do what I want there in advance. So in the future, if we need to do something, cough, cough, Taiwan, we can. And that is, I think, what is so scary is we have public information that the government has put out that the Chinese have been doing activities on critical infrastructure since 2010. Now, my assertion to those time periods were the following. One, it was more iterative intelligence. They wanted to understand what was there? How did it work? What was our response? You don't know how your tradecraft works until you actually do it. I have no doubt that they have sophisticated ranges to technically validate this, but that's not the same thing as an operator being on target. Now, the key here is they never wanted to cross the proverbial red line. They weren't trying to cause impact. They just wanted to see what worked, what didn't work, and how it looked. And why this new intelligence on Volt Typhoon that has come out, I believe the reason the U.S. government has been ringing the alarm bells and everybody's going red is because it's no longer an indicative of that kind of training and intelligence. It's the levers that they're trying to put in place to be able to do this. Now, when we get into this space, folks immediately start thinking about military cyber weapons. And that would be like what we see with InDestroyer out of the Ukraine. InDestroyer, which was first released, I can't remember if it was 2014 or 2015, was a traditional military cyber weapon where they deliberately built code for the purpose of causing harm. Because there's very little difference in code from it being good code or bad code. It's mostly intent. And this goes back to what you were talking about using sysadmin, living off the land, binaries and scripts, lolbass, the functions that are inherent in the environment to just work for nefarious purposes other than intended. And then we can see where my point is about how you can't just release this stuff, because the update InDestroyer 2, when it was released in 2022, during the restart of the war in Ukraine, it was very slapdash. It was clearly had not gone through the same development cycle and did not quite have the same amount of success. Now, I do want to give credit. That is a significant credit to the US government and some private companies that did a lot of work to make sure that's the case. Now, going back to what we see with Volt Typhoon, they haven't given us all the detail, but that's my read with what the government has publicly stated, is this clearly was put there as a lever to do something in the future. My assertion, because I've been saying this for several years, is we know that the Chinese want Taiwan back. And I think that's going to be the first action. And I'm a former tank commander. And so I always tell everybody the best M1 you ever have to fight is the one that doesn't show up on the battlefield. And tied to the Army Cyber Institute, we had a program called Jack Voltaic, which looked at the interdependencies of critical infrastructure sectors and force projection and force deployment. You don't just fly a tank over there, right? You typically ship them. And there's a lot of civilian infrastructure that goes into being able to project force. And so if I'm the Chinese, I'm going, well, the best way to stop an M1 from showing up is making sure it never gets there. And our critical infrastructure, I think, is the lever that they're using for that future conflict.
What you're saying is, for those of us watching this from the outside, it feels like a looming, you know, threat to the general community and population of us just living, who like, you know, running water and power and all those goody things. But you're saying the intent is way more specific than that, although there's going to be fallout that's going to impact possibly larger communities. Because we talk about the defense industrial base, but it's really so much of everything we have in the country ties to our federal government and our military operations directly or three hops away from it.
And by the way, this is my personal hypothesis that I've had for some period of time. There is no official statement in there at all.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that's clear, that in the official announcement from the Department of Justice, they didn't provide a lot of clarity about what the end target was. These SOHO routers were just a jumping off point, but they only said critical U.S. infrastructure and left it at that. But the scenario you laid out does seem entirely plausible.
And would be out of DOJ's remit.
Right.
That's a national security DOD intelligence community thing.
This reading between the lines is interesting, because when I first read the announcement, I was like, okay, so some folks out there had some old, I think it was Cisco and Netgear routers that they're just using to run, you know, a small branch office or even their home. And the FBI is breaking into these routers to remove malware. I'm like, is that a service they're providing for everybody now? Or this must be an indicator of something much more dangerous.
That alone is a significant statement. The U.S. government went onto private equipment and changed it.
Right.
Now, obviously, we can point this that this was for good reasons, but there is a precedent for that. And this is the talk I gave at Cyber Week in Tel Aviv in 2021, because we had the same thing happen with Microsoft Exchange. There were four vulnerabilities that were released and that were exploited. And the FBI went and actually updated those routers to remove the malicious web shells that had been installed and were in operation. And the way that they were able to do that is they went to a federal district court in Houston, and there were two changes to the federal rules of criminal procedure, which is called Rule 41. And it was the two definitions, which were one, a protected computer, which is anything that affects interstate or foreign commerce or communication based on their connection to the internet. And then the key qualifier here is that those computers were damaged. And how they argue that is because unauthorized web shells impaired the integrity and availability of those systems and data. And therefore, the DOJ was able to get federal court permission to then go in and make that change. And the other part of it was, in one jurisdiction, because the interstate qualifier meant that they were able to do it anywhere inside the United States from that ruling.
Yeah, and just so it's clear, in this case, the KV botnet malware, the Department of Justice did go and touch those boxes, reached out to those devices, and removed malware from those devices, and has taken additional steps, again, severing them from a command and control service. But they actually did go to these devices, log into them, and remove malware, which I didn't know they were allowed to do, but apparently they did it with a court order, and that is the thing now.
Now, somewhere I read in this particular case with the KV botnet that whatever they did was not in persistence, and if you rebooted the device,
right,
it reverted back. Did you see that too?
Yes, the DOJ also said the mitigation steps that it took can be reversed if you just reboot the router. So they didn't make permanent changes. They just wanted to disrupt the network. And also, I think they're trying to contact the folks who own these devices to say, hey, you need to replace them or update them, I guess, again, because they're end of life, so there are no software updates. But yes, that is correct. You can reverse what the FBI did with a reboot.
And then we saw also Lumen doing some stuff in this space as well to try to redirect some of that traffic on the internet side, I think, like they were rerouting traffic.
Yeah, I think that was the CNC disruption. Yeah.
So they were taking the traffic from the command and control servers and redirecting that, I think, out to some black holes or somewhere else. So I'm kind of curious, you know, how long that, it's like having a tractor beam, right? How long can you keep that up? So definitely interesting times here. And, you know, I think the prevalence of these older devices, you know, because again, you know, SOHO stuff, we have all of the residential things that are floating around. And really, you know, those of us that are network engineers, like we think in the enterprise space, you know, oh, all of these switches, routers, firewalls, access points that we have in the tens of thousands. But the truth is that these SOHO and residential equipment eclipse us. You know, we're a blip on the radar compared to what's out there floating in the rest of the ecosystem. And so it's not as simple, and we don't have the centralized visibility and management of these things. So I think it's going to be almost a fool's errand to try to get everybody to update these devices.
Bryson, I think they'd call this a target-rich environment, right?
Yeah. Well, they don't even know that they have them. They don't know where they are. Departments go and get stuff. Good luck finding the people.
Yeah. Again, this was the talk I gave at RSA in 2018. Personal IoT, which is only exponentially increasing. I mean, when you look at routers, you're not going to really have more than one router per household. But how many IoT devices are there going to now be per person in that household? And that's the part that's exponentially increasing. And the design structure of IoT is cheap, mass producible. And at the end of the day, the real part that unlocked it was the fact that I just need comms, right? It goes to the cloud. The cloud does the analysis. That's why I don't need a lot of computing power, which allows me to keep it cheap, keep it small, keep it lightweight, doesn't need a lot of battery, because the cloud. That's where all the work is done. And it's all based on communications. And that, again, going back to that gray space that I was talking about, is why it's so interesting and so easy to use for that.
So maybe this is a good time then to transit to the point of having you here, Bryson, just to talk about red teaming and blue teaming and so on. Maybe just sort of start us off with your definition of how you see these different spaces, red team, blue team, purple team, et cetera.
Sure. So blue team is your defensive posture. And I want to give a shout out to Sunil Yu, who I think is the smartest person in cybersecurity. Sunil has a book, and it was an RSA talk in 2017, called The Cyber Defense Matrix. And it is the five phases of the NIST CSF: identify, protect, prevent, detect, respond, and recover against the categories of assets. And the takeaway here, when you're looking at your blue team, your posture, which is a combination of people, process, and technology, just sit and do a quick 5-minute exercise of plotting what you got against that matrix. And you're going to identify two things. One, gaps. That's easy. I don't even need to do a risk assessment to learn from it. And then the second part is you're going to see a lot of overlap. And those are your opportunities to figure out, am I overpaying? Which again, particularly with the way the economy has been the last 4 years, businesses are looking at security as a cost center that needs to also be not just increasing the budget every year, but prioritizing. So how do I measure blue? At the end of the day, this is why we have so much existential angst in this profession, is because we don't know. We don't know until that Friday evening of a 3-day weekend is something going to happen, right? And the real red, of course, is the black hat, is the bad actor who is trying to do something like we were talking about with Volt Typhoon. And so security is defined by the threat. This is data science. So I need to drive a signal that looks at that. So the first thing I'm going to qualify is, let's not call it a red team. It's called a red capability, because so few companies have the resources to actually have a red team or outsource a red team. But that doesn't mean that they don't still need to be able to drive that signal, because it's the only way to effectively test your assumptions. And there are free tools. Red Canary's Atomic Red Team is a great starting point that a blue teamer can use on their own. So that's why I like to call it a red capability. And at the end of the day, what we're looking at is, how can I realistically, safely, repeatedly, and at scale drive that signal to understand the edges of what I prevent or what I detect, because those are the two categories of controls that I have in blue. I'm either stopping something or I am seeing something and eventually alerting that to get a human operator involved to investigate further. The prevention is the limitation because nobody can do that blindly for everybody. This is why there's no silver bullet in cybersecurity. You've paid for CrowdStrike and CrowdStrike's doing a great job, but the problem is CrowdStrike doesn't know your business. Your business is continually changing and CrowdStrike can't block a legitimate business process. Going back to the comment I made about Volt Typhoon, the difference from good code to bad code is more the intent. And as JJ mentioned earlier, they're blending in. They're using the functions you already have. I love PowerShell. PowerShell is great for IT management. It's also a fantastic tool for me to attack with because it's everywhere and it's organic. And I look just like everything else. And so the point here is that if CrowdStrike in that instance blocks something legitimate, how many strikes do they get before you rip it out?
Right.
And this ties back to the limitation of threat intelligence, which is why core threat intelligence is the basic three IOCs. Hash, IP, domain, because it's highly unlikely that that would ever be a good thing if I found it as a bad thing. It's unlikely. So I can guarantee that. But the problem is, that's an analyst 6 months ago finding something, confirming that, and now it's just table stakes because it's so easy to change any one of those three IOCs in a real campaign. I mean, I add a zero to a file and it's now a completely different hash signature. The way I describe this is, it's like a six-year-old walking up to a bar and CrowdStrike's the bouncer and going like, you can't get a drink. He goes, okay. And he walks away and he's literally in eyesight of the bouncer and he puts off a fake mustache and he puts on that fake mustache and he walks back. He's like, can I have a drink now? And he's like, sure, come on in, right? Because that's the limitation of prevention.
Let me pause you for a second. What's red team or red team capabilities versus pen testing? How does that mesh together? Is that the same thing? Is there overlap? Is it different?
So there are multiple ways to skin this cat. The starting point for everybody, and this is actually research we pushed out at Scythe, where we have a maturity model of how to look at offense. And the starting point for everybody is vulnerability management. Vulnerability management is a compliance exercise. Thou shalt find things that are misconfigured or are known vulnerabilities, and thou shalt fix them. Except you can't fix all of them, so you only skim the things off the top, which is why we have Patch Tuesday and Exploit Wednesday. Because there is an entire ecosystem taking advantage of all the things just below the level of what any company reasonably can patch. And it's Sisyphean. I run my scanner. I see 50,000 vulnerabilities. I knock off a few. I run the scanner. There's 50,000 vulnerabilities again. You never get through it and you don't know what you're accomplishing, which is why it's really a compliance exercise. So then when we step it up, this is where we start getting into penetration testing. And penetration testing commonly is seen as the compliance exercise of, I'm supposed to have an external risk assessment once a year, check the box. I prefer a different definition. So if you're going to call that a risk assessment, right, that is a mandatory third-party risk assessment. To me, the definition of penetration testing is, what can I do to gain unauthorized system access? Well, with vulnerability management, that's going to be misconfigurations or vulnerabilities. But there's a third option now when I'm actually doing real penetration testing, which is, how can I trick a box? Because there are just ones and zeros I can throw in a certain way and it gets confused and I broke in, right? So that's that view of how do I get in. Then red teaming, purple teaming, adversary emulation, and red teaming. So we recommend purple teaming as the first step when you start looking at these, because a red team, the way I define it, is you have human operators who are using the limits of their imagination to try to break in. And then what can they do once they're in? And that's really powerful. It's also really expensive. And if you aren't sure where your defense is, I mean, like if you started boxing, your first fight shouldn't be with Mike Tyson. You should start sparring and you should practice the punches and the routines that you got. And that's what purple teaming does. So simplistically, purple teaming is the fact everybody has graduated from preschool and you know that red plus blue is purple. I would like to expand that definition to a collaborative milestone-driven exercise. And the reason I would like to do that is the collaboration is the key part. In the definition, that's typically red and blue, but it doesn't have to only be red and blue. Why can't we bring in HR, finance, PR, legal? Why can't we make it more than that? There's more benefit with other cross functions outside of just security being involved, including IT.
Yeah. Is purple teaming then like I'm internally putting together a red team, not an external group, but my employees is a red team and some of my other employees are a blue team and seeing what happens and that makes it purple? I guess I'm confused about the delineation here.
again, this is why the core of red plus blue. Blue is our operational posture. What are we? What do we actually do against our assumptions? What do we see? What do we block? It's preventative and detective controls. And I need to drive a signal to test that. And that's the red capability. What purple is doing, the collaborative milestone driven exercise, is we're going to set that scope and what we do together. You're not going to just break in. We're going to say, well, we're really kind of concerned about those business servers because it's tied to a new release that we're going to be doing. And that's really important to the business. So that's going to be our scope. What's the threat model for that? Well, the threat model is we're concerned about them breaking in this way and then doing these things. That's our milestones, right? Those are the procedures we're actually going to do to drive a technical signal. We're going to prove it in the environment. So purple is the open box of, you know what we're going to do, you see it while we're doing it, and we all review it together.
But it is an engagement with an outside entity acting as the red team or that red signal.
Does not need to be an outside entity.
Does not, okay.
You can have your own internal red and blue. You can drive your own purple team exercise. You can have somebody else come in and oversee the exercise. You can have, because the process of doing a purple team is like anything. There's a maturity to being able to do that effectively. Where most folks struggle, which Drew is where you're getting to, is that emulating or simulating the red capability is typically the hardest. It's a very niche skill set. So that's typically where, if you're bringing in somebody to do a purple, they're also going to be doing the red as well. I can speak from our experience when we do these at Scythe. The other value we do is we're also fixing things because that's the blue part. So we're helping them build stronger detections and reconfiguring things for a better posture based on what we've done.
It sounds like, you know, obviously eat your veggies, do your 101, your basic NIST CSF and CIS controls first, do your vulnerability scanning, then your defensive teams are appropriate. But then it sounded like purple team was the next step before you got into. And so I'm learning in this process too. That's interesting to me. So would you say like the capabilities that you're looking for, you could have, I hate to say more junior, but you could have somebody who's less experienced in each of those areas and that the sum is greater than the individual pieces for this?
Yeah, because the value is planned and proven by that exercise as opposed to, hey, somebody came in, they won, they threw a book at us as a report and they said, fix these things and they disappeared. That's the traditional red team experience, right?
What I'm kind of like picturing in this whole scope thing is if you let a red team loose or whatever is going to be doing something that's offensive like that without some parameters and you let them just kind of go for it, you might be worried about somebody, you know, jimmying the front door or getting into your garage door and kicking that through. And they might just throw a bomb in the middle of the house and call it a day and say, we're in, right? So that makes sense to me. And I'm really curious about that process and building that team. And then also, like, you're talking about bringing in other people. I'm feeling like this is a great opportunity for, you know, the technology professionals and network architects, admins, engineers, security architects to play a role in this as well, both learning and understanding offense, defense, and then also contributing what they know about the architecture, because there's just so much stuff that's not documented well.
And that's one of the things I like about purple teaming is it facilitates communication, education, and training naturally, because that's what the process does. And for so many folks, again, the red capability is the black box of unknown. The closest I ever got to it is I watched a bad Hollywood movie. And not only is that not realistic, I didn't really get anything about that I could learn from. Here, you get to see it. Oh, okay. I didn't know PowerShell could be misused that way. That's really interesting. Now I know that, right? Now I've seen it. I've learned that. Now I can start to think about that in my own space.
So aside from these group exercises, how do people get those skills? Because I'm still trying to tease in my own head apart, like, because I think there's pen testers that run that are not really pen testers. They're people who use open source tools and spit out a dumb report. And then there's actually pen testers who have really great offensive skills. And then it sounds like red team capabilities are maybe another step beyond that.
They're different. I don't know. I'd say beyond, it's different. So a penetration tester, again, I'm breaking into a system. A red teamer, I am executing tradecraft where I am avoiding your detective and preventative controls. I am staying stealthy. So there's a real tradecraft component to that. The commonality is, so I always joke, there's no such thing as a junior red teamer. This really speaks, I think, to security as a whole. I think there's really no such thing as a junior person in security. You have to have a strong technical foundation in hosts and networks and applications. Until you have that, then it's really hard to know all the edges then on how to abuse them. which is where penetration testing and red teaming is breaking and finding the holes in assumptions. But you have to know it well enough to know where those are and how to do that effectively.
I'm smiling, even though everybody can't see me, because I feel like this is the drum I've been beating for so long, which is, you know, we have all of these technology professionals who have been, you know, sysadmin, network admin, whatever they're doing. And they've been told by peers in their organization on the security side that they're lesser and they don't work in security and they don't get it and they're not really invited in. And you have all of these job requisitions open for security roles. And you have people coming out of college, and a lot of them are super sharp. And I always joke, but it's true. The high school kids I mentor can kick my ass and run circles around me in a lot of areas, but they're also well taught in the foundations. They understand the OSI stack. They understand networking. They understand layer two, layer three. They understand application control. But when you take somebody and you don't teach them those things, how can you possibly defend that?
You can't.
When you don't understand how the packets move around.
Yeah.
And that's why I love this idea that, you know, we can take network engineers and architects and, you know, can do so much more.
As part of a team, it sounds like the folks with not necessarily security domain expertise still have a lot to bring to the table, especially to me, it sounds like in a purple exercise where you're essentially like doing a very controlled experiment with boundaries that everyone can observe and see what happens.
I think it would happen before that even, because when you're talking about building your defensive capabilities, that can be really valuable input.
Absolutely. And again, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you're in a different department, the company got breached. We're on the same team. And then going back to the conversation from the news we've been having earlier, even if you're in a different company, we're all in this together. So folks talk about shadow IT inside a company, which are rogue devices, rogue software that gets brought in for different reasons. Well, there's also shadow internet. And it's the fact that unknown botnets would be a shadow internet. But the other one that I think most people aren't even aware of is that all of these companies have different connections, either temporary or permanent, with each other. And if I, as an attacker, can ride that, you would never see me.
Bryce and I both consult for IONS as well. And so we did a tech brief on that. And one of the things we were talking about was the Cloudflare, Okta chain. Like you just follow each of these major breaches and you go back and you go back and you go back. And then the supply chain, the business to business relationships. And, you know, I think if you kept digging into this most recent one, going back into the Cloudflare and then three hops back into Okta, they managed to rotate thousands of credentials and tokens and missed a couple. And one of them that they missed was a service account from an Okta developer or team member who had logged into his or her personal Gmail, a personal Google account from a work computer. And that is actually how that enterprise credential was stolen. And that was the snowball that led to the breach. So yeah, all of these tentacles between companies and relationships, B2B, B2C, it's crazy.
Hello, podcast listener. If you've ever wondered why no one's talking about IPv6, we've got good news. IPv6 Buzz is a twice monthly podcast dedicated to this essential and sometimes perplexing protocol. IPv6 Buzz will equip you with everything you need to know about planning, deploying, and operating a V6 network. Hosts Ed Horley, Tom Coffeen, and Scott Hoag literally wrote the books on IPv6 architecture, deployment, and security. They share their knowledge and speak with other experts on topics including unique local addressing, DHCP V6, SLAC, firewalling in IPv6, and much, much more. They also answer listener questions, so if you've got a burning IPv6 issue, you may be able to get it on a show. So plug into the future with IPv6 Buzz. Find it on packetpushers.net or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're in the point now of these conversations where we're just the wet blanket of security. And it's like, well, gloom and doom, we're all dead. We didn't even know we were already dead. Somehow we're still going. So let's find a silver lining. When you look at what you can control as a defender, it's your stuff. The attacker is not bringing 007 gadgets to your network. That's not what we got to worry about. And if they are, then that's great. Let's make that the cost that it takes to breach you and to do something. So first, let's get out of the mindset that we can keep the attacker out. The perimeter is dead. And I say that, and I think a lot of people agree with me, but I cannot tell you how many conversations I have with security executives where they say yes, and then when we get to how they're prioritizing, they are not actually prioritizing that way. They continue to try to build higher fences, electrify them, and have sharks with laser beams prowling the moat. It doesn't work. It never will, because it's going to be the example you set. It's going to be somebody accidentally opening an email. It's going to be whatever it's going to be. They're going to get in, because it's not just a technical problem. Right? It's a social one too. So fine. So what? What they do next is on your computers. They only speak the way that you let them, with the users that are defined on them doing what they do. They have to go where you are. Now, the trick is you just need to find your baseline well enough, hence repeated exercises like a purple team will do that, and then you'll be able to identify those anomalies. And the other part that's really interesting is while there's a lot of novel ways in that gray space, like we talked about, and a lot of novel ways to break in, once they're in, it doesn't get very novel. I can't promise you you'll stop O-Day. Anybody who ever does is selling you something or lying. But I can promise you, since they have to go to those same places, the attack logic, and it could be a different actor, it could be a different campaign from the same actor, always will have some collision. May not be the first step, but I assure you, if you focus on these kinds of exercises within a few steps, you will start catching things in your environment that have never been seen before because they have to go to the same spots. That attack logic has a collision. We can take the power back.
We can do this.
We can do this.
That's encouraging. Yes.
I have a question because I downloaded a white paper. Well, it was emailed to me and I was reading it and it talked about...
You wait, did you just open a PDF without inspecting it?
Old school, baby. I got the paper printed. But it was talking about behavioral indicators of compromise. And I was hoping to ask you a little bit about that.
Okay. What's your question?
What is that? What does that mean?
What is the white paper? What does the white paper say? Did you read it?
Well, no, because I was like, well, I'm talking to Bryson today. I'm going to ask him about it.
Can you summarize a white paper that JJ hasn't read?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I was clear on the definition so I don't misspeak, because I think it's the things I've been talking about. I'm looking at this. This is where I'm talking about is it's the fact that attacker behaviors have to converge. The logic follows a set pattern. There are things they have to do. I always joke about this. Like, an attacker isn't going to break onto your computer to play Minecraft. I mean, even if they did, you don't care, but they're not going to. They're going to do discovery because attackers are not omniscient. I don't know exactly where I am or what this means. I'm on a computer. I know where I'm. I know the company I'm at, the organization I've broken into, but now what? Where am I compared to where I want to go? So I do discovery, and there's levels of discovery that I can do. And then from there, I need to move laterally, right? And so this is where I like to point out the MITRE ATT&CK framework is not a bingo card. You cannot just be like, we solved lateral movement, because the state of those behavioral IOCs, the state of the attack from the procedures that have been executed and the success and what's been done with the procedure dictates what happens next. If I've stolen a credential, my ability to move laterally is going to work. And the credential, the specific credential I stole also dictates that, right? I am that user, me going from here to there, that's going to look like something completely different to a defender. That's the behavioral IOC. Those are the state basis we need to understand how MITRE ATT&CK is going to be used. So the way I like to describe it, because I really like Bruce Lee, is atomics, simple IOCs in behaviors are, like I said, using it as a bingo card. I know what hydrogen looks like. I know what oxygen looks like if we were to use the MITRE ATT&CK like a periodic table, but that's not what water looks like. And that's what we need to be defending at, is understanding how these elements combine and those state bases, those chemical equations, we're defending and being water.
If I'm thinking about engaging with an organization to red team or purple team, what kind of deliverables should I be expecting at the end of this engagement?
Well, a red team is going to explain what they did and their recommendations. A purple team, since it is transparent and milestone driven, you're fixing as you go. So the outcome of the purple team are the fixes.
I mean, honestly, from a value proposition standpoint, based on our conversation, it sounds like purple team is kind of highly valuable, even maybe more than a red team engagement, unless I needed to click that compliance box.
I mean, a red team isn't a compliance requirement. That would be the annual pen test, which, as JJ mentioned, I can, you know, do a Nessus scan and charge you $5,000. That counts, right? Okay. What I would do is, again, purple teams are incredibly valuable, but the limitation is going to be the essence of surprise and imagination. My point is, start there, because surprise and imagination isn't what you need. You need to know where you stand, then grow to where surprise and imagination are the edges of that understanding.
You know, areas in your organization that you feel are weak, start with the purple team engagement, shore those up. And then when you feel a little more confident, try the surprise and imagination element with the red team.
Yeah. A red team is Mike Tyson.
Okay. Right.
We've got Bruce Lee. We've got Mike Tyson, unicorns.
I mean, I was an Army officer. I did work in the intelligence community, and I am a martial artist. So I guess there's a theme here.
I want to know from a, I guess, twofold. Maturity of the organization, and loosely related to that, maybe size or flavor of organization and industry. Where do you tend to see Purple Team be appropriate to introduce in terms of that sort of matrix with the organization?
I don't think that's vertical or size independent.
Okay. So, well, I'm assuming they would need at least a certain amount of structure and maturity internally to even have the personnel and the teams to coordinate a Purple Team activity. So where is that?
So you're actually bringing up a good point, and this is part of what makes a Purple Team a little bit harder. So a Red Team obviously needs some kind of legal and management sign-off, but that's it. A Purple Team, because the preparation and the cross-functional element means you need leadership buy-in. I need folks to actually show up and be there for 4 to 8 hours. You know, it's not like we just get an extra day each year, although technically we do this year with February 29th, but it doesn't feel like it counts, right? Nobody gives you a free day. So you are carving that out of priorities. Mm-hmm. That takes leadership buy-in.
Can you give us an example without, like, obviously without naming names in any way, shape or form, but can you give us an example of like how this might manifest in the organization and just a sample case of org has these teams, these people, resources, they bring in this person, external, other team, whatever, for X number of days, weeks, months. What does that engagement look like?
Sure. So there are three variables to a Purple Team exercise: scope, frequency, technical complexity, or realism. Scope. You can gain a lot from just playing with a gold image in a lab. You will learn what actually detects or protects on a host in its basic image. You now do that in a live environment, and you're going to get that plus how long the telemetry takes and what is correlated to alerts at your SIM, which is either internal or with an MSSP, right? And so these are examples of simple scopes that have great value. And that's an area, particularly Red Teams, we joke about is like attackers don't have scopes. Well, we do for these reasons. Then frequency. How often are we doing these exercises, right? We can do one a year and figure it out. We recommend you really want to aspire to quarterly. That's a good cadence for the organization. And then the final piece, which is why I call this red capability versus red team, is how complex does this attack need to be? I mentioned a free tool earlier. Red Canary's Atomic Red Team is a free tool that is easy to use, and you can just pick procedures from it, press buttons, and it does it. Now, it's not going to do a sophisticated red capability. It's not something you can go across an organization, but it is a good starting point for that. So those are the three variables around then answering the next piece, which is all I need is one person that represents IT security. That's a minimum. One person can do this. I can sit in the lab, script out my exercise, and do all that. So if you're small enough to have that, you can still do it. More folks, larger scope, bigger exercise. It's just growing with the size of the organization.
So that barrier entry is pretty low. What are some of the resources? If somebody's listening to this and going, wow, this sounds cool, I think I/my organization can benefit from this. What are some good resources?
So I know somebody named myself who does free Purple Team webinars for IT and OT. They're two different webinars because I also show how to do that in industrial control systems safely. But I do a 45-minute webinar. I think the next one is on the 20th. So if you go to the Scythe webpage, I teach this for free. We have a Purple Team exercise framework that we've done with multiple folks in the community. I think we're on version 4 now. So it's not just like our view. A bunch of other folks throughout industry have weighed in. And it is a step-by-step in detail. It's 20-some pages on how to run a Purple Team. Another thing I'll point out that came from a collaboration I did with George Ruchias and Adam Ashinchi, called the C2 Matrix. We created a compendium and a decision-making tool. So there's over 100 free and commercial command and control frameworks. And there's a wizard, so you can go in and be like, this is what I want to do. And it'll tell you what the best ones are for that. And it's not subjective. It's technically what can they do. And then from that, George did a collaboration with the SANS Institute, where we created a Kali Linux distro called Slingshot that is also free. And it includes a number of free red and blue tools already baked into that distro, which installing and making these things work is, I don't know, probably 75% of the pain. So we've solved that for you.
Nice. Thank you for that list. Drew's taking notes so we can put those on the links.
Yeah, we'll have those links in the show notes that accompany this episode.
Well, I want to ask you about something. I want to pivot a little bit here, but before we wrap up this part, I want to just kind of say, so as we've been talking, the way I just kind of in my head I think I've defined red team versus pen testing is, it sounds like pen testing is breaking in and red team is sneaking in.
Yes, because breaking in is noisy.
So the idea of a red team is to subvert the detection.
Correct.
Okay.
And I don't want to say breaking in. I say unauthorized system access, because not only can it be how I gain access to an enterprise, but it can also be how I continue to gain access inside of an enterprise.
So the other fun thing I wanted to ask about is shifting gears just a tiny bit, but you also host Hack the Planet podcast. And I have in my little reminders flag to go download. You recently did one with the CISA director, Jen Easterly. So I'm really excited to hear about what you guys discussed there and what the listeners here might want to go check out.
Sure. So the E is silent. It's just Hack the Plant. That's part of the joke. Yeah. So for season four, which we just debuted episode one with Jen Easterly, it's a pretty wide-ranging interview. And the reason I wanted to do it is I wanted to catch up, as CISA has since come out with her being the director, what their priorities are with critical infrastructure, water, K-12, and municipals.
Did you guys dive into the priorities and how they arrived at that? That's an interesting blend there.
I mean, it goes back to what, to add from what Drew said, and this is where we talk about target rich, but the addition is the cyber poor.
I think we're all feeling very cyber poor these days.
A lot of folks are very, I mean, this is one of those things, right? We talk about this in financial and equity about the top 1%. And you look in cybersecurity, it is the top of the top of the top percent are the only ones that are kind of the haves, the cyber rich. And everybody else then falls off very quickly into cyber poor very fast.
Well, speaking of other kind of fun free resources, is I did want to at least mention the ICS Village, because I do hope that Drew and I will be able to have you back sooner rather than later and talk more about, you know, the critical infrastructure security and some of the stuff there. Obviously, Bryson, you and I are doing a talk at RSA about that. But ICS Village, you guys do a lot of cool stuff there and have free events and training. So maybe you could give us a thumbnail.
Sure. ICSVillage.com. We do 10 to 15 events per year. The three big ones are RSA, as JJ mentioned, and at DEF CON. We also have our own policy conference called Hack the Capitol. This year, it's going to be the 29th through the 31st of May in DC. We bring together members of Congress, directors of agencies. So you'll probably see Jen Easterly again there as a keynote, and academia, think tanks, and industry. What's different this year, and this ties back to a philanthropic grant we got from the Gula Foundation, we are building a hands-on workforce development program tied to national apprenticeships. So kind of going to where we're trying to solve some of the problem of how do folks get into this. You don't need a four-year degree, making it more like a trade tied with industry that will then formalize an apprenticeship that you come into to learn the rest of the way. We're going to be debuting that on the 29th. So the 29th is with veterans, disadvantaged college students, and then the policy conference will be on the 30th and 31st. I'm on Twitter at Bryson Bort, and I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. There's not many Brysons.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Bryson, for being here. I really appreciate it. JJ, that was a really good conversation, and I feel like I've got a better understanding of red, blue, and purple. And there's a lot of great links here that we'll have in the show notes if you want to get more into this and maybe even to have an engagement yourself for your organization. That does wrap up this episode. Thank you for listening. You will find the show notes for this episode at packetpushers.net. While you're there, you're welcome to join our Slack community. You can hang out virtually with our IT professionals, ask questions, share advice and tips, and swap useful links. As always, thanks for listening.